beer gardens, swimming pools could be more attractive at the moment, but yeah, it's worthwhile to be here. We welcome you on behalf of the Heinz von Förster Society and the Department of Contemporary History to join us for this year's first Heinz von Förster lecture. Paul Pandaro is talking about designing our world, cybernetics as conversation for action. Let me introduce the speaker of today just in a few sentences. Paul Pandaro is chair of the MFA Interaction Design, a newly created Master of Fine Arts program at the College of Creative Studies in Detroit. Pandaro started his studies at the MIT in 1969 and received a BS there in Humanities and Computer Science in 1974. He was invited there by Nicolas Negroponte to take over a job and became member of the research staff of the architecture, the legendary Architect Machine Group, which morphed into the MIT Media Lab later. When Gordon Task visited the group at the MIT, Pandaro gave up his role of being the first PhD student of Negroponte's and moved to England in order to work for and with Gordon Task. Pandaro worked within the framework of Task's company, Systems Research, and in 1986 he received a PhD in cybernetics from Brunel University, where Task acted as his supervisor or advisor. After being active for a time on both sides of the Atlantic, Paul moved back again to the US and doing consulting and startups. From the 1990s, he lived in the Bay Area, meeting Heinz von Förster regularly there, just living nearby. He started teaching at Stanford University in Gary Winogrand's Human-Computer Interface program from 2001 to 2007. After moving to New York City in 2007, he has taught systems and cybernetics for design at the School for Visual Arts in New York City from 2010 to 2014. Paul Pandaro's career spans research, consulting, startups, and education. His most recent startup is General Cybernetics, dedicated to new ways of reading and writing in digital media based on Gordon Past's conversation theory. He has worked with and within startups in New York and Silicon Valley in product and technology roles. His consulting clients include DuPont, Nokia, Samsung, the Instituto Itaú Cultural in Sao Paulo, Ogilvy and Mestre, Intellectual Ventures, and the Poetry Foundation. Paul lectured in Sao Paulo, Paris, Berlin, Vienna, Linz, and in cities in the US. His writings explicates designing for conversation from his research and his implementations of software and organizational processes. Besides of his business, Paul organized part of his own collection as the North American Gordon Task Archive. Some years ago, Paul donated this collection, which represents a perfect overview on what Gordon Task was working on, to our Department of Contemporary History, where the North American Archive now is kept with the name PPPC, Paul Pandaro's Task Collection, and serves as a source of research and serves as a valuable complement to the Gordon Task Archives the department received from Gordon Task's daughter, Amanda Heidler, more than 10 years ago now. I personally had the pleasure of meeting Paul for the first time in the late 1990s at the Rattlesnake Hill in California at Heinz von Förster's home. Paul took Nicole Finsinger, sitting over there, myself out for lunch to a restaurant in nearby Palo Alto where we had a long conversation from which a permanent contact emerged. For a long time now, we had the wish that Paul might do one of the Heinz und Förster lectures here in Vienna. There have been some practical obstacles until now in earlier years, but this year everything turned out to be viable. The event is supported, today's event is supported by the City of Vienna Department of Culture. We say thank you to Daniel Röckel, the new director of the Office of Science Funding, as well as its former, now retired director, Christian Lehmann, and the staff of this office. We are also grateful for support by the faculty for historical and cultural studies. Thanks goes also to Werner Korn, who helped us again with most beautiful posters and invitation cards, to Marianne over here, Marianne Ertel, who did much of the administrative work, and to Christina Wieler, who takes care today, tonight, for the video camera. Many years ago, Paul told me an anecdote. As far as I can remember, it goes like this. Heinz und Förster and Paul Vangaro met at a conference where Paul talked about some topic of cybernetics. Heinz addressed Paul before he started with the following words. Paul, you are standing on the shoulders of giants. Tell me, what can you see?
Thank you so much, Bill. Thank you for such a beautiful introduction, and thank you all for being here today. It's a kind invitation to come and address you, and I hope to show you or to tell you a few things that I've seen by standing on these shoulders. Thank you, Albert, for remembering that wonderful story. I come to you from Detroit, most recently, as Albert has explained, from the College of Creative Studies, and I want to spend just a minute contextualizing that. The school's been around for 100 years. It was born out of the arts and crafts movement and has largely been an undergraduate institution with about 1,600 students, 1,400 students, rather. And some years ago, they began a new program in graduate studies, of which there are these four programs. And we have about 60 students now, and we hope to make them grow. And for the last 2 years, I've been chair of this master's program in fine arts in something called interaction design. Now, people often ask me, what do you mean by interaction design? And I take this as a wonderful invitation. I can do one of two things. I can ask them, well, have you had any interactions today? And I interrupt them. And I say, have you had any interactions? And in this way, I turn around the expectation of just getting an answer to creating an interaction. And usually what people say is, oh, yes, I've had some interactions today. And I say, well, how'd that go? And they very often say, well, some of it was good and some of it wasn't so good. And I say, well, those that weren't so good, those we want to design better. And with this story, I try to expand the notion of interaction to as broad as possible, to as human as possible, and as completely far away from technology as possible. Because most people want to say, oh, that interaction design thing, that's digital, right? No, it's human, it's us. Another story I might tell, again, depending on circumstances, is to invoke an interview with the comedian John Cleese of Monty Python fame. Some of you may know of him, a world-famous comedian in his time. And an interviewer begins his video interview of John Cleese by saying, Mr. Cleese, you're a very funny man. And Cleese frowns, and he won't have any of it. And he says, no, it depends on who I'm with. So to me, this is another goal of interaction design, which is to create the conditions to be in a situation in which you can be what you want to be. Or as Heinz once famously corrected me, he said, Paul, you keep on talking about ontology when you really mean ontogenesis. So this is why I say now, not just the conditions under which I can be, but rather the conditions under which I can become. And so this is another way of answering the question, what is interaction design, and what do I hope to teach my students in interaction design? I'm not entirely new to Vienna, although this is the first time I've been here, other than in November. So it's a pleasure for me. I hope it's not too warm for you. And on a prior occasion, when I came to this particular conference in 2003, I was pleased to speak about the relationships between Pasch, Maturana, and Heinz von Forster. And this is a postcard that Heinz sent me in response to a question I had about him, had for him in how organisms interact with the environment. And he felt that I wasn't getting the distinction quite right. So as typical fashion, he sent me this beautiful postcard. And of course, it's the bottom one that is the way organisms interact with their environment. It's through looping through the environment. The top one, by the way, is AI's mistaken model. And the middle one is something in between. I was here again in 07, and in 2011 I wasn't able to travel here, but Albert and others kindly invited me to give a talk by a video in which I described the archive, now the collection that Albert and the Institute now kindly take care of, which I couldn't. I carried it back and forth between continents and so on. I'm very glad it has a good home. And I also gave a talk, a little bit of a tribute to Heinz, who as Albert said, I had a great pleasure in being in Pescadero for some years, near Pescadero where they were, he and Mai, after they retired from Urbana. Here they are sitting in the back of my DS21 Citroën on our way to Duarte's Tavern, where, of course, we always had a meal and extraordinary conversations. And I miss them both very much. I had known Heinz from earlier, from the conference that Albert referred to, in which he said, when you stand on the shoulders of giants, tell us what you see. And this is the context in which, or the preamble at least, in which I'd like to talk about designing our world. What does it mean to design our world? Well, I think you know what I mean. It's a bit like asking you, who would you like to be today? What is the world we want? What world do we wish to live in? And how do we wish to live together in this world? I don't know if you're familiar with Edith Ackermann's work, but I want to open with her for a number of reasons. You'd be amazed at her clarity and originality. She was a student of Piaget, and then a colleague of Papert at the Media Lab. Papert attracted her to the Media Lab. And she influenced, through the course of her time there, and afterwards over 30 years, many, many students. The number is apparently about 80 students whose thesis she was involved in one way or another, either as close advisor or as more remote advisor. Edith knew Umberto Maturana and was a strong supporter of cybernetics at MIT, a much more rare thing than you may know. And here she speaks of her interest in learning in terms of designing our own worlds. She went to MIT in part under the promise from Papert that they would do the cybernetics of children's learning that Piaget had not quite done. But it was not to come about. She passed away last year. And I and her strong colleagues from MIT miss her terribly. But she understood this idea of designing our world, and I think she also understood of what it means in my title to have conversation for action. I feel like, as I say in my abstract, conversations between mind and hand have occurred since the dawn of our species. We want to design a world. We want to do something in the world. Here she answers some points of view on that with the word tinkering. Now, I don't want you to know that tinkering in this context doesn't mean trivial playing around. It means something rather more careful and thoughtful. It's become a term at the Media Lab. And let me ask Edith to speak for herself.
So what I am trying to understand in greater depth is the complex relationship between the mind, the hand, but also the eye, and how the mind, the eye, and the hand can actually achieve their magic if you let them do their things with materials that are rich enough to continue the person actually to want to go to the next step. Importance of the I and the importance of actually thinking of learning as seeing you. And I believe that in your tacit way of thinking about tinkering, for you the I is very important. And yet, we always talk about the head and the hand and the tool. And the playfulness in it all comes from the fact that instead of just looking for the reasons why you don't get what you wanted, the creative side of tinkering comes when you actually almost voluntarily sometimes put yourself in such a way that you can see it differently as a result of tinkering. So this act of I put myself aside, I backtrack just to allow myself to look at something in more than one way is a key to interesting forms of tinkering. Because otherwise tinkering is nothing else than trial and error. And I want it to be something different. So it's in that sense that I insist heavily on the seeing side of things. In the very definition of tinkering, it all comes down with the ways in which you look at the discrepancy between what you got, what you thought you got, and what you read as having gotten when you made a move. And not enough attention has been paid to our ability to let ourselves see different things, even in one image.
So I have many reasons for showing this. One is I feel that her ideas are very clear and she hasn't had the recognition that I believe she deserves. She's also courageous and willing to do a takedown. Do you know this American phrase, takedown? It's when you criticize something and you bring it down a peg. You say, it's not so great as what you thought. So what she's taking down here, which you may or may not recognize, is the logo, or the motto rather, of very, very famous institutions, mens et manus, mind and hand. And this, of course, is the motto of MIT, where she is. So she's taking down the motto of MIT. It's fantastic. And furthermore, she has a transition for me in talking about another great thinker who spoke about this idea that when you write something with a pencil, that the person who's writing is different than the person who's seeing the writing and thinking about the writing. And of course, you may know who that is. Ranulf was my dissertation advisor with the PhD he did with PASC, and he was very, very difficult, as those of you who know him may realize. And this is his view of describing what Edith was talking about. This, for me, is the act that makes design design. And now, of course, this is where conversation is introduced, and indeed, the cybernetics of conversation. So here's a definition of design that you may know. Anyone know it already? Herbert Simon. Why doesn't he say cybernetics? This is the most purely cybernetic definition I've ever seen, as pure as any I've ever seen. So what do we have here? We have existing situations, which we might call the current state, preferred situations, which we might call the desired state, courses of action, detection and correction of errors. So this is a perfect pattern of first order loops. But it's a little convoluted. Let me give you a quote that's rather more direct. Here's another one. So you can see he gets it in the sense that, having been a student of PASC, Glanville himself would understand the power of conversation. And if you've seen his other talks on this, you would know that I'm using him to stand on top of. I'm standing on his shoulders in this case to make my main points. So the we in this is Hugh Dubberley and myself, longtime colleague and close friend for a number of years. And we've revamped a paper of ours that will be published soon in a volume by Springer. And we would also make this claim. And in fact, this is the moment when I think I just leave the stage, I'm done, and you know everything you need to know. But of course, it's not that simple, and I really have to justify it. Unfortunately, I think there may come a day when I don't have to justify it. So let me walk through a logical justification of these statements. So I'm claiming that if you are designing, then you must be concerned with systems. Now, I mean systems in a couple of different ways. Digital technology clearly are systems. And there are systems of systems. Internet of Things is the classic example of this now. And design has gone from giving form to creating systems that support interactions. A phrase we hear a lot today is platforms. Amazon is a platform. Facebook is a platform. There are many others in business and so on. But of course, human interactions are also relevant to the systems that we want to take into account. So we have to model and tame this complex mesh of mechanisms, and therefore, systems literacy is a necessary foundation for design. And my colleague Hugh Dubberley has written and presented on this magnificently. So, if systems, then cybernetics. Why? Because digital interactions comprise reliable connections and unreliable connections and communication and feedback. Human interactions comprise purpose, feedback, learning. So, the science of communication and feedback, interaction and purpose is cybernetics. So, again, we claim that we must model communication and intention in a common frame, and that common frame is cybernetics, which becomes necessary as a foundation for design. We're not through. No surprises to those of you in the audience who know second order. Let's go further. So this idea of wicked challenges or wicked problems, as coined by Horst Rittel, and I mean it in the strict sense, not in the sense of complicated problems, but wicked problems, meaning they are messes that cannot be untangled by simply deciding what to do and doing it, because deciding what to do is already difficult, some might say impossible, and there are many other qualifications for wicked problems that I won't go into. Now, you have to articulate what you want and why you want it. These are human values and viewpoints, but of course these are subjective. And when designers are proposing their plans, their designs, their ideas, their approaches, their concepts, they have to be persuasive in them, not just to persuade the other designers in the conversation, but to persuade anyone involved. And these persuasive rationales are in themselves subjective. So modeling subjectivity is the province of second-order cybernetics. We must embrace the values and subjectivity at the heart of designing. Therefore, we're not quite done. Anyone want to guess what's next? So taming these wicked challenges requires conversation, because it's grounded in argumentation. And without being able to argue and have a conversation about it and a back and forth, then you have no collaboration. We have to come to some understanding and agreement. If we don't agree, we can't act together. If we can't act together, we can't. So if agreement is necessary for collaboration and effective action, then we must embrace these things at the heart of 21st century design. If these wicked problems are the problems of 21st century, and therefore conversation is a necessary foundation for design. And this, of course, is where PASC comes in. So this is the argument that we make. And I want to make one other distinction. This argues that design is conversation, or design as conversation is the frame. But if we are designers, we want to enable others to have these conditions also. So we must create conditions for others to have conversation. So design is conversation, and we as designers should design for conversation. And of course, we can't think of second order without thinking of Heinz. The turn of cybernetics his connection to the Macy meetings, his influence on Margaret Mead to name an article, Cybernetics of Cybernetics. The conversations he had at the BCL, at the Biological Computer Lab, were intermixes of different points of view. Many, many different individuals coming together from many different points of view. So many, including Gordon Pask. To speak of conversation is to speak of Gordon Pask, because of his conversation theory. A scientific approach to the nature of interactions, languaging, whether person to person, person to group, group to group, or person to oneself. His model did all of these things. Just as Glanville speaks of when he talks about watching yourself drawing with the pencil. So Pask saw this potential and began to explore it with his experimental machines, which led to a theory, which led to his body of work and to other things as well. This is a form of cooperation. It's a form of conversation, too. Here's another form of conversation. This was at Amanda's wedding. The look on Gordon's face, I think, is priceless. Anyway, it's a walk down memory lane with an intention. I spent a lot of time with Gordon. I was so privileged to know him and to do a PhD with him and to have a place to go from where I had been, which was not really very satisfying to me. I never thought artificial intelligence would do it. I didn't know why it wouldn't, but I had that intuition. And when I found Gordon, I found my way. He had many contracts with US and UK governments, agencies over a period of years, psychologists on both sides of the Atlantic interested in applications of his theory. But he also worked a bit in academia, and he developed a way of thinking about conversation by beginning from, as he says here, observers recording equipment. He was the observer. And by recording, he generated a series of frames and points of view and elaborations and models. He shows the emergence of learning, of agreements, of the coordination of actions. Of the coordination of the coordination of actions, as Maturana would say. These are his own drawings. And here we have a full-blown conversation with stratified levels in language. The upper levels are about goals, and the lower level is about the means to achieve the goal. These are feedback loops of whether that is coherent and working or not. This is the environment in which actions take place. And we have a participant on the left and a participant on the right. A completely cybernetic model of conversation, including its subjectivity. Now, this is Pask's definition of an architecture machine. So to the right of the vertical is the computerized participant, and to the left of the vertical is the human architect or the designer, and they're having interactions at multiple levels. And they're internal and across exchanges of all kinds. These diagrams appeared in this book originally. Nicholas had asked him to write an introduction to machine intelligence, and Gordon found an opportunity to bring a lot of ideas together and some diagrams and a lot of thinking into a more formal specification, I think is not too strong, of what a conversation is. Now, Negroponte at the architecture machine interpreted Pask and proposed a machine with which an architect could have a design conversation with a machine. This is the design as conversation idea. But of course, the outcome of this design would be a space of possibility. It would be an architectural space, a virtual space, a literal space, or a metaphorical space. A space where conversations should take place for design. So the designers are creating a space for designing. Design for conversation and design as conversation. And in 1976, 67, these were the things that were going on at the Architecture Machine when it began, and when I was there from 76. It had begun to morph already into more about technology and interactions, and ultimately about playing with these new devices and seeing where they would go. So this vision, the original idea of an architecture machine, or really any machine with which a human can have a conversation for design, has never been built. But I hope and wait for that day. Now, what is this thing called design, and how do we talk about design? There's a thing called design thinking that I'm sure you've all heard about, and I want to breeze through this. But I need a foundation from a common language to move to what I'm proposing as an alternative way of thinking about designing. You might think of this as a takedown of design thinking, in the sense that Edith Ackerman did a takedown of the MIT motto. I want to bring it down a peg. And by design thinking, I mean not the hype or the branding, but rather the idea that there's a process for doing design. This is the conventional way of thinking about it. We have these three steps. So we observe users, preferably in their ethnographic state, or we are in our ethnographic state and they're doing what they're doing. User-oriented research. Contextual research is another term. Then you have your brainstorming phase in design thinking, or as my colleague Hugh Doberly likes to say, post-it notes and pipe cleaners. It's intended to be a bit of a takedown. Don't be confused. And then you make something. You prototype something, and perhaps you make something that can be tested. But what does this really mean, and how do you actually evaluate it? And indeed, how do you iterate? Now, this word iterate is fascinating because, as taught by Heinz, iteration means you do the same thing over and over again and probably get the same result. He always liked to correct and say, no, you mean recursion, which is the doing again on top of the doing before, such that you're going somewhere. So a spiral, not a circle. A movement forward. But where are we going? Where is forward in this case? How do we know that we're getting somewhere? What are our criteria for evaluation in design thinking? How do we go from three things that we do to a methodology? Well, one way of beginning, at least for me, is let's think about what we're trying to do for the users. We're trying to help the users achieve their goals, right? So can we measure improvement from users and say that this prototype is better than the prior prototype that we've recursed over, and therefore we're making progress, we're converging toward what we want, or not? Did the users get what they want, or not? And of course, as designers, we have goals ourselves that are different, in a sense, they're a different abstraction level. Did we get what we wanted from it? And of course, I'm thinking about all of this as I'm looking at design thinking some years ago, and I'm saying, well, wait a minute, really, all of this is about conversation, isn't it? And isn't what's in these three levels of boxes called design thinking, isn't this just a conversation to agree on the means by which we will get what we want? So conversation is the core. And of course, the purpose of the conversation is to get the means to achieving the goal that we want. I'm sorry, I just said goal. Did I say goal? I don't see goal here, do you? Oh, we see design goals and improvements for users. That kind of improves goals. But there's nothing on the slide about goals yet at this core way. The big thing is about conversation to agree on means. Where the hell is goals? So let's think about this again. Let's start from a conversation to agree on means, and let's acknowledge that we should probably also have a conversation to agree on goals. Right? I mean, it's sort of common sense. But I didn't see this in design thinking called out explicitly. So the question then becomes, is this conversation to agree on means something that achieves the goals that we want to achieve? It's like, let's go to dinner. How are we going to do that? We're going to walk up the street. We're going to sit down. We're going to eat. We do all of those things, and then we say, did we have dinner? These were the means. Did we achieve our goals? We can do this at any level of abstraction, of course. But then, who's in the conversation about goals? Where do the participants for that conversation come from? Where do the participants for any conversation come from? Well, are you on the team? If you're on the team, then you're in the conversation. Well, where does the team come from? So another way to cast this is to ask the question about variety. Now, I'm sure many of you know the idea of variety from Ross Ashby, another of the cyberneticians that we know and love, and who was at the BCL, of course, for many years. And Ashby's concept of variety, technically, is the number of states available to a system. But I prefer a softer way of talking about it. It's the capabilities and capacities of a system to respond to changes in the environment such that the goal can be achieved again. The classic case is this room. If you had air conditioning, I could use it as an example, but we don't have any air conditioning. But simple feedback loops, of course, have a certain degree of variety. They can handle a certain amount of heat, but not more than that amount of heat. So we can apply, colleagues of mine and I, have applied the concept of variety to the conversation. Do we have enough variety in the conversation to achieve our goals? To achieve the conversation to agree on goals and to agree on means and so on. So this invites the idea of a conversation to design the designing, you with me? From the point of view of variety in the conversation, explicitly. So it's not just, hey, you know, we all work together, we're going to be on the team. We have to be more cautious about it. Now, it goes on, right? This idea of variety, you have to be curious about variety in a number of situations. And of course, you have to iterate and evaluate, or recurse and evaluate, to make sure that you're achieving your goals. And this gets a bit convoluted. But for a moment, I wanted to dive in and talk about a specific method for designing conversation for variety, because so far I'm up at this abstraction level, and I want to give two examples in the course of today of something more operational rather than something formal and abstract. So let's imagine you have a conversation, and you start it with these three people, these little E's, and maybe a few more on the left. These are little people, and you're going to have this conversation. And in the conversation, you're going to build new knowledge. Let's hope, right? If we're not building new knowledge, we're not really having a valid conversation. But then, we're done with this conversation today, and our meeting is adjourned, or our time is over, and we're going to plan a next conversation. So who is in the next conversation? Should it be the same people? Well, that's, of course, what a team means. And everybody hates being on a team, because every week you have all of these meetings, and you constantly hammer at something, and some of you are needed, and some of you are not, and many of you are missing, because you don't have the variety for the next conversation. We know in the next conversation we want to answer this question, this question, this question. Well, us five are not enough. So what if you explicitly, from the group of people that you could choose from, which may be your organization or outside of your organization, anyone you can find, and you choose a few new people that you need because this next conversation is going to need them. So you create this selection mechanism where you choose who's in the next conversation. Every time. Every time. And of course you may need new information to come in for the next conversation. So this becomes a pattern. And you can apply this pattern across any given habit. This is a habit from advertising agencies, where a client calls, that's the catalyst, you have a bunch of ideas generated, you create a solution, you deliver the solution, you evaluate the solution. Each step of the way, you can be applying this particular pattern. So this is an offer for designing the design of the conversation. Conversation to design the designing, as I say it here. It's a way of being very explicit. Okay? Now there's something missing, I think you know. Have you noticed? Something missing. And this thing haunts every organization. It's something called innovation. It's how do we get innovation? One of the great buzz phrases of the era. What does it mean? It's a bit like design thinking. We kind of think we know, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And how do we integrate that into this whole thing? Well, back to Heinz, and back to another colleague of ours, Michael Gagan. He was a PhD chemist and MBA and cybernetician actually, and he was at DuPont for many years. And he, having absorbed and applied and extended the ideas of Heinz and Pask and Maturana over the period of his career, became a tremendous resource for me and a constant catalyst in conversations ever since. In the 80s, he was my client, and then we changed roles, we flipped roles. Here's a shot of Don Schoen, who you must know, and myself, and Mike Gagan, and Gordon, and Frank Galushka, also of the American Society for Cybernetics, writer and painter. Anyway, as a result of this interaction with Michael Gagan, when I was his client, we looked at the rise and fall of DuPont as a great company, and also the company that I was at, which was Sun Microsystems, which had a rise and a fall. And we saw some analogies. And as a consequence of that analogy with Hugh Dubberly, again, a colleague who I mentioned, we produced this book, which can be downloaded. And Hugh did a beautiful job of designing it. And now this is the second dive into something specific about one of my four squares in my model that I want to talk about. This may seem like a hidden kind of statement, but I think if you think about it for a moment, you'll realize how true it is. First of all, by language, we don't mean English or German. We don't mean the language of design versus the language of engineering. What we mean is, what can we think about? What can we say? And what can we learn together? It's the distinctions and the relationships that we have available to us every day. If you can't talk about it, you can't do anything about it. And what we found in our analysis was that many companies can't see that the world has changed. It's not that they see the world has changed and say, we're fine, we're not going to do that. It's like, huh? I don't think there's anything different. I'm just going to keep doing what I've been doing and everything's going to be fine. As it turns out, you create a language with another individual, with the groups that you're in, with the organizations that you operate with, and you don't know that it becomes a kind of closed and private language. It's very convenient to have this language because within yourselves you can be very efficient with it. Because you have a shorthand, because you know someone for 2 months or 2 years or 5 years. And this efficiency becomes seductive. The problem is, it increases your ignorance because you can only see what the language allows you to see. And in particular in business, it becomes narrower and narrower to be more and more efficient and to make better and better what you're already making. So it's on this convergence path to cause you to fail if the environment changes, as it will. And lately, environments have changed very, very fast. So you have a limited future vision because of the language that you're operating with. You're using the language of your past today, and the world has changed, and the future will be yet more different. And so, what can you do? How can you innovate? Follows as the night of the day that you have to expand your language. You have to create new language, by which I mean new distinctions, new framings, new ways of seeing, new relationships. It's a bit like Bill Gates saying, hey, I don't care about this hardware thing. I'm going to make software separate, and I'm going to conquer the world. He's still the richest man in the world. Terrible software engineer, by the way. That didn't matter. This was an insight that he saw that IBM did not see. And there are many, many examples. So, to regenerate, an organization must create new language. So, in this framework, you need a conversation to create new language if you wish to innovate. This is my claim. This is the model I propose. We can't talk about organizations and we can't talk about managing them without talking about Stafford Beer. Stafford's viable system model is such an elegant piece of design. And it pulls beautifully from the nervous system and from concepts of variety and, of course, deep concepts of feedback. And I've started a conversation with Elena Leonard, who carries on Stafford's work, about this notion of variety and conversation. It's a very early conversation. With her, these are my ideas. They're hardly worked through. But in Stafford's model, you have the system 3, 4, and 5. And system 3 is the brains of agreeing on means, because it operates in the here and now. So what are we doing? How are we doing it? How are we getting there? System 1 and 2 are the things that carry this out, but system 3 is the brains of the here and now. System 4 is the seed of strategy. Sounds to me like agreeing on goals. And there's a relationship between 3 and 4, homeostatically, hence the big black arrows, that is maintained. But I'm proposing that this is really a conversation to agree on goals, and that this relationship goes back and forth to what he calls the system 3-4 homeostat. It balances present needs and future needs. System 5 at the top is about policy and identity and coherence, as well as exploring options. So this feels to me like a hybrid of these two. Now, again, this is an early proposal. As you know, Stafford's CyberSyn project in Chile in the early 70s was decades ahead of its time. I only wonder what Stafford would make of the work today in big data, because he was dealing in big data in a sense, right? It's the country of Chile. He wants to collect all of the production numbers and economic operating numbers on a day-to-day basis to know what's going on and what can be regulated and how it can be adjusted. This is a brilliant idea. Now we have the technology for it. It was a rigorous and cybernetic way of looking at things. So system 3, 4, 5 in Stafford's model also beautifully exists elsewhere because it's recursive. Oop. Let me go back. Hold it. Let's see. No, I've lost it. Never mind. What I was going to point out is here, it's a recursive and fractal model. So this square here with system 3, 4, 5 in it is also here. So 3, 4, 5. And also here, 3, 4, 5. So the viable system model is fractal and recursive. And therefore, these components can take place at these other levels in the model. I'm simply trying to point out the pattern of conversation and design for action. And here we are. So this is the main part of my journey I'd like to offer today. A few wrap-up ideas, and then I hope some challenging questions. This is the statement I made earlier. Now, many of you will recognize this from Umberto Maturana, who first pointed out that when we want something new, we might reflect on what it is we don't want to be new. What do we want to conserve? And this insight is so fabulous and so valuable for students and so valuable for imagining a new world. If we have a new world with technology in it, what do we want to conserve? What do we want to carry forward from before we had that? This is from a talk that Umberto gave at this systemic design conference in Toronto, which I moderated via video, as best one can do in those technology constraints. He was present at many of the 80s conferences in the American Society for Cybernetics, which is how I first met Heinz. And Varela was also there on one occasion, actually. And of course, famously, Maturana, Varela, and Uribe wrote one of the earliest, if not the earliest, papers on autopoiesis, although Uribe is often not remembered. He's been in Urbana forever and was also part of Heinz's conversations there. I want to quote Maturana briefly. He was speaking of human beings in contrast to all living beings. So in the context of human beings being different than other living things, he says, the only thing peculiar to us is that we human beings consciously choose the path we follow in the conservation of our living. We consciously choose the path we follow, and therefore, we are responsible for what we choose. We are responsible for the world we want and the world we want to design. This is pure past, really. This diagram is the final diagram of the article in Negroponte's Soft Architecture Machines. And it's the ultimate moment, really, because we have a participant on the left and another on the right, and we have a crisscrossing of interactions at different levels, which, if one delved into it, one would understand to be the collapse of the distinction between the two. Think of it like a dance. So I begin dancing with you, I move you, I shove you, I control you, and you think, you just pushed me. And this occurs at the lower level. But then you realize that the upper level is a consequence of the feedback of this push, that, ah, he is dancing with me, and I want to dance with him, and therefore, you push back. This is the crisscrossing of these levels and across the participant barrier. We have the same collaborative goal, and we act in concert. So we become one. The distinction is lost. We are living together in action. We are living together in conversations for action. So I have a little more of a logical wrap-up. Now, cybernetics and all of these people I'm talking about are all over this. Conversing about goals and being transparent about frames, these are second-order viewpoints. They're about language, they're about ethics, they're about von Forrester and Pask. Conversing about means, this is Heinz and Pask and Stafford Beer again. You may not see all of the connections, and I don't have time to draw everyone out, but I assure you that that's where this comes from. Co-evolving new language and living together in language, pure Maturana, pure von Forster. Designing the design, Ashby for variety, second order for self-reflection. So this is my construction. I stand on the shoulders of giants. I can't not, because the power of what they offer is too great. And the power of what they offer is at least what we need, because the challenges of 21st century design are indescribable. In fact, it's not that just the challenges of design, but the challenges to design. How do we design for these things? As I mentioned earlier, these are wicked problems. They're not complicated ones or simple ones. They're worse than those. They're wicked problems in this strict sense. And so we have to acknowledge that, and we have to do the best we can, because we are responsible. We're proposing this notion of second-order design, design for conversation. So again, we want to design such that others can design. If design is conversation, then we want others to have those conversations. design as conversation, design for conversation. Why? And of course, I think all of you recognize this last point, which comes directly from here. So this has been the journey. Thank you for coming. Standing on the giants, thank you. Standing on the shoulders of giants and bringing action in and remembering Edith and remembering that, another great Heinz quote. And this is what we want from all of our giants, is a place to stand. So, thank you very much. Thank you all. I appreciate your time.
So, thank you very much for your wonderful presentation. One could, of course, pretend that all of the questions that might come up are answered already. In your symmetric perfect scheme, but maybe it needs some comments, and I ask the audience to...
It's not lost on me the irony of trying to talk about conversation by giving a lecture, and therefore this is the most fun for me, so please. Yeah?
It's maybe to add another wicked problem.
Okay.
That I see is that the actual times of perception, and people are no longer capable of it because they have effective conversation, as I talked before, then the perception and the action circle doesn't work out, the relationship is unstable, and then you come and reinvent new language, but it serves no purpose. Now I wonder, do you have a place for the wicked problem that we have actual living dancing organisms which have to practice dancing together, and if they don't see and perceive and feedback, all the other concepts don't help because they can't coordinate themselves. So where does the dancing come in of our human organisms in the conversation practice?
Well, the dancing is everywhere. But I think you're pointing out that these pristine graphics show something that's very clean, and when it operates, it's messy. And it's the wicked problem that you mentioned. And the bad news is it takes time to work out these messes and to work out the misunderstandings. The good news is that sometimes innovation comes, or new ideas come, insights come from the misunderstandings,
yes,
from what I thought you understood. So I don't have a better way of thinking about it other than that.
Just a comment concerning system design.
Yes.
In large systems, system design, you normally go with some assumptions which you have in the beginning, towards a goal which is sometimes very fuzzy.
Yep.
And that, of course, is the dead end speed if you start going this way. And I think iteration loops, as you pointed out, wouldn't lead to the desired goal, particularly if you start off the wrong foot. So one of the ideas and themes that the beginning, the assumptions, the requirements, seem to be completely clear, and the goal is fuzzy. And that is a very common problem in large system design. So one of the solutions which we apply in large system design issues is to focus not rather on the requirements so much, but on the goals, make them clear and unique and evaluation possible. So it's a completely different approach.
Yes.
You actually start with the fixed definition of the goal, and from there you identify the needs which you need to have in order to achieve.
So you worried me when you started talking about requirements, because starting from requirements is already one place to start. Deverly did a beautiful map of the creative process, which I recommend to you. You can go to his site and find it at deverly.com. And the creative process can be thought of as observe, reflect, make, observe, reflect, make. But it doesn't matter where you start. Some say you should make first. I think that's an oversimplification, but this is very common now in prototyping and software design. Requirements say you observe first and you gather requirements, right? Reflection would mean, oh, what do people need? I'm not going to think about it in their terms. I'm going to think, right? So starting anywhere, I think, is a trap. And what I'm trying to say is that you have to be much more flexible in realizing that it's only by going around this eigen loop.
Now, this is not the point I'm trying to make.
I'm sorry.
What I'm saying is these circles do not make any sense in achieving a particular goal, which is a requirement.
So let me come to the goal idea. I agree that that's different.
Okay. So if you do not have a very precise understanding of what the goal is, there's no point of starting.
I disagree completely.
I think we start someplace and we don't know where we go.
I think that it depends on the problem space, where if I have to know my goal ahead of time, then I'm paralyzed to action when I'm trying to solve poverty. Because I don't solve poverty by giving people money, and I don't solve it by giving them jobs, and I don't solve it by giving them homes. It's some combination systemically of many, many different actions, which in a very narrow way might help some people. That's not solving a problem by knowing the goal ahead of time. That's trying and going around. So I would submit that in a second order design concept, even the goal is subject to being challenged halfway along.
Yeah, but one of these days you have to fix it.
One of these days you have to act, and the action might test whether or not you have the right goal.
Let's say you want to design a parking accelerator as an example. Complicated machine.
Yes.
If you do not exactly understand what a particle accelerator is and what it requires to be actually function later on, you have a problem.
You've got me on that. You've got me on that because a particle accelerator is a very, very clear goal. But wicked problems are not clear goals.
Yeah, okay. But, you know, for this person, because we deal with this kind of problems in industry quite often.
I understand industry is different. Yes. No, I don't disagree with you in that sense. But in the frames in which I'm trying to talk about these global problems and wicked problems.
Yeah.
Who's next? Albert, can you adjudicate?
Helps. Of course, the goal is correct. But the goal is not specific enough. So it could help what we call the legitimate interest. It's a specific task-based approach. And then I have a context, a specific context in that it could help.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's, on the one side, I have the empiric, on the other side, on the second order, I have the logic.
Mm-hmm.
And for the logic, I need a specific interest. For example, in law, you have the legitimate interest, it has to be specific, concrete, embedded,
Good. These are fair frames, different frames. Good. Good. Thank you.
Okay. That's the frame where it fits perfectly, the whole theory that is working with organization, change processes, or anyhow to I've always consulted for organizations. And it was very, very easy for me to find out where is this finding common goals, finding measures, finding a design architecture in which I work to find this.
Mm-hmm.
Where I still get stuck is the point how I enter this innovation, this new language.
Yes.
Is it just by bringing new words,
you've caught me. It was the example I didn't give. Right, I gave to the third if I thought I had time. There's a notion that we've developed called a focusing question, where, and I can send you something on this, there's a description of the elements of a focusing question. It has to be consistent with the DNA of the organization, of who you are now. You then see, who do we not have now in the sense of variety that we might begin to add in this cadence of conversations and the example I gave you. And there, it has to participate in the culture or the society or the economic way of making money of today. So Negroponte's way of saying this, it's about bits, not atoms. So it's about Uber and not about a taxi company, although there are political reasons not to talk about Uber anymore. Lyft. But still there are problems with the gig economy. I don't want to go down that thing. But you're right. I can send you something on this which goes down that path a bit more. You've caught me out that I did not go into that. It's a design, it's a sub-problem of designing, which in its own is a very, very difficult problem. But essentially the focusing question is, what can I do and work on that's small enough that I can make progress on, that I can have a goal and I can make progress, and yet not so vast that I don't have the resources to accomplish this in the broad sense? You made a jump there that I'm not sure I'm going to go with you with, but I can answer the first half. The selection mechanism, at best, is something that the organization itself allows to happen. There's another diagram in that sequence that, again, I can send you. Feel free to write to me, and I'd be happy to send it to you. But the idea is that instead of me selecting or you selecting, we offer the problem, as we currently understand it, to the community. And if this person thinks that they can contribute to that, they offer themselves and they offer a direction that they would take. And then they are brought in, by whom I'm not sure, but by some consensus operation. So that even though they have no power, in the sense that they don't have a position of power, they don't have a role of power, but they have an idea that has power, then the recognition of that idea becomes the way in which they become part of this cadence of conversation. And then the team morphs over time. So that's the beginning of an answer to your question, at least the first part. And perhaps it answers the second as well. Okay, great. Thank you.
I would like to know if your model of conversations maps to the practice, to the everyday practice in academia, in science, and in the environment we are here now, or is there a difference? You especially mentioned organizations, economical organizations, consultancies, and everything.
Yep.
How is it in science and
It's probably less like science than it is like the way that we engage person to person every day. It's based on PASC. It's a way of taking his conversation theory and thinking about the elements that he talks about, which are context, so what moment, what frame, what situation is it? Language, how do we begin back and forth again? Language in the sense of distinctions and relationships and how we think and see and value the world, not in terms of German versus English. We have an exchange. We may come to agreement about some things. And if we come to agreement, we may act or transact together. So context, language, exchange, agreement, transaction. Cleat, like the English word cleat, like you have on the bottom of your shoes when you play football so you don't slip. It's a silly acronym. But these are the components of a model that simplifies, oversimplifies PASC's model of conversation. And those are the components that I would say are the elements of what I mean here. So if you begin a conversation with someone, you have to be aware of the context in which you open it, and in which the language, and the language that you use to begin it. And then from there, it's a dance of agreement and on and on. So that would be a partial answer, I think, to what you said. Is that helpful? Thank you. team?
Who can be member of the team? Because in the age of we live now with machine learning, I think that the content of the team also includes other species like machines or other species. Because the focus after your talk, I always think about human beings, but in a design, in this concept you present here in design, machines. Are machines also part of the conversation or not?
You can have it any way you like, because the Paskean model of conversation doesn't make a distinction between what makes the participant. It might be me and you, it might be this group and that group, it might be me and a machine, it might be a machine and a machine. So the qualities that have to take place there, I don't much mind. However, today I was not talking about with machines, except to refer back to Pasque's influence on Negroponte, who wanted a design conversation to be about that. The other comment I would make about teams is when I present this set of slides that you saw, I very often end by saying, don't design the team, design the cadence of conversation.
You mentioned the importance of variety.
Variety, yes.
Variety of methods.
Yeah.
Conversational kind of platform.
Yeah.
This social environment implies that there is a very strong feeling against variability. We don't want to have people, immigrants who are different from us here in Europe and in America too. How can we overcome this counterforce?
The only thing that comes to mind right away is the arguments which I've seen. There was an article, I think it was an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently, which was written satirically, actually it may not have been in the Times, which essentially said, we don't want immigrants. And we don't want immigrants because, by the way, 47% of the new companies were invented by immigrants. You know, and it's a series of statistics which shows you the power of variety by allowing these other points of view and these other cultures and social norms and ways of thinking into the conversation. So counterexample is, I think, the only way I can think about it, the only logic I can imagine. But that doesn't change people's minds. That's a matter of starting with the conversation again and having a context in which we can start with something that we share, I'm not sure what that is, with the kinds of people who are making these objections. There was a discussion in America about wanting to persuade people to vote the way you would want them to vote. So I'm an advocate for a particular party or a particular candidate, and I would I would knock on your door, and I would know that you would probably disagree with me because I know something about you or I know where you live or whatever. And the recommendation was not to say, hi, I'm here, I think you should vote for so-and-so, but rather to start a conversation about common values. So, hi, how are you? Nice day. I have kids. You have kids. Oh, that's interesting. And establish this human commonality before saying, I'm for the opposition as far as you're concerned, or I believe in women's rights, or I believe in gay rights, or I believe in something. So, to establish this common agreement about what it means to be human before you create, at a lower level, if you will, what the objections might be and what the polarities might be. So these are the things that come to mind. It's a wicked problem.
Your last remarks were a little more differentiated than before. Like when you gave your model first, you said conversation leads to agreement before you even say that conversation to agree on goals. Well, you know, when was the conversation when we were splitting on goals? You know, I think you give the impression that agreement is better than disagreement, and in a sense, you say on one occasion, I completely disagree. Completely disagreement is not possible. I think, you know, it's just a rhetorical phrase.
Yeah.
But in order to disagree, we need to agree. So we start off with an agreement, and that will lead us very often to disagreement. And especially, I think, when you talk about creativity and so on, you know, then disagreement at a certain point, you know, is leading to creativity. Agreement is impoverishing it, you know. So I think you have emphasized, in my opinion, in your model, far too much the idea of agreements. Agreement is better than disagreement, consensus better than dissonance, and so on and so on.
I agree with you completely. But I'm not being facetious. You're right that in, again, I mentioned a minute ago, these models are pristine and clean, and I should have qualified much better what I mean by these things. Pask, of course, had the idea of agreeing to disagree. So yes, it can be presented in a way that acknowledges the messiness and also the necessity. Yes, yes, what comes before, yes.
That very often leads to disagreement, and you may have seen that our discussion here, in a very friendly way, this conversation has led to disagreements. Mm-hmm. And you ask him for it, you know. In other words, you say a conversation which leads to disagreement here in the hall, you certainly prefer to a conversation which ends in agreement, you know.
Thank you.
That's often, yeah.
Thank you. No, thank you. You've helped me do it better next time. I'm sorry?
That's the difference between discussion and discourse.
Discussion and discourse. I see. Okay. Thank you.
I think you should actually disagree with yourself in regards to the usage of one term.
Yes. So I want to clarify what I meant. I didn't use the word persuade, by the way. And the context of that remark was that if I am in a design discussion and I have an opinion about a design choice, then it is up to me to persuade others in the discussion from the point of view of my rationale, my logic, my reasons. The classic case is, and I do this with students sometimes, hi, I want this square to be green. It's a pixel square on this interface, 50 pixels by 50 pixels, and I want it to be green. You say this to a group of students, and they say, well, why do you want it to be green? And I say, exactly. If I can't argue why I want it to be green, I'm not a good designer. Because design is always now in the context of the system of conversations in which together we have to make it. I can't make this app on my own, I am part of a team. The team has to make the decision. And therefore, I have to be able to argue my rationale for the decisions I'm making. That's the context in which I made this. I didn't mean it, and I will clarify in future, that I'm trying to persuade the user of something. No. And in fact, we had this discussion earlier today. One has to be very careful about the control or even the influence you want to have on the person for whom you are designing. And of course, even designing for someone is a concept that's moving away. I want to design such that others can design.
I agree.
Thank you.
First, thank you for the brilliant talk.
Thank you.
My question, I am in the interaction design business, and when it comes to a practical application of your model, solve the wicked problems by design, for example, social or helpful, whatever. We always struggle with the term design for people because I think it's about designing with people, at least there's this concept of co-designing, for example.
There's a third one, designing by people. And this is what I meant by second order design. And this is what I was trying to allude to there. It's me creating the conditions for you to be the designer that you want to be or to become.
With some controversial thing, other side is, as I experienced, don't get me wrong, but normal users, for example, interactive systems, are not really designers because if you ask them, I want green, the other one says I want red, and it's not, for me, not the goal of the user to design, but to say what they want to achieve, and the designer has to role to bring this out for them to convey the meaning for them.
But these are two different domains of design. I don't want to enable a designer to just configure their screen to have green pixels. I want them to be able to design their life.
Yeah.
I want them to design situations like John Cleese to be with the conditions that they want to be with so that they can be who they want to be and become the Heinz distinction, to become what they want to become. Now that's much harder. And students say, well, how do you do that? And I say, let's talk about it. Because we're not yet able to build tools for others to be the designer. But that's the philosophical goal, if you will. But thank you, these are important distinctions. Why do you want stability?
Well, I think you have to anchor yourself somewhere. You have to find sort of a place to be secure in, so your creativity can sort of, you know.
So where is that? Is that in the goals, which you may or may not have clear?
Well, I'm not talking about goals. Maybe it's value. You know, I mean, we have to define what design is or what goal is. I mean,
values. Yes, absolutely. Yes. That is the stability.
Would it be something that you would like have for use what I want to say, I mean, you have to materialize it in some way. Conversation is also externalizing thoughts, right? It's also a materializing thought.
Yes.
So that we can understand each other and converse on the topic. So what do you do with that value? I mean, that value also develops during your process. How do you use it?
You go around the circle. More subtle version of the circle.
So you come back to it over and over again and refine it or redefine it.
Define or redefine, yes. Yes. I agree with you that you need some stability. That's like the stability of entering a conversation with someone that you know you will violently disagree with at some level, but you start by saying, oh, you have kids? Yes, I have kids. Oh, do we want to live together? Yes, we want to live together in the Maturana sense. Do we want to live together is the way he asks the question. That is the ultimate stability. And from there, our choices can come.
Yeah, so that's the right question.
Thank you.
This may sound a little paradoxical, but I'm wondering about the philosophy behind what you're presenting. And I have a hunch that there's an idealization of action. Rather than an idealization of problem solving, for instance.
Yes.
And the paradoxical question here is, could you design for non-action?
No. I don't think so. Because it's only in this loop that you get anywhere.
Yeah.
It's the mind, the eye, and the hand in Edith's terms.
Okay.
Because I don't know. It's if you wish to see learn how to act. It's back to Heinz again. I don't see how to get around that. Otherwise, we're building intelligence in a box and not. It's the same problem with AI.
Right.
Is there some reason why you want non-action?
Well, it could be one of the answers of. I didn't see the syntactical imperative. In my mind, there's the word option in there. I always quoted with the word option. And so that's weird.
Option instead of choice, you mean?
Right.
Heinz didn't mean option.
I know, but that's where I have a problem with his quote.
But you know what he meant by choice. He meant a viable option. So I can go to a restaurant and order anything on the menu. These are all options. But I don't like spicy food. I prefer not to eat this. I won't eat that. So my choices are narrower than all of the options on the menu. So choice is a potentially viable option for me. That's what he meant. And that's why he chose choice and not options. And that's why I become vociferous when people insist on misquoting him. I mean, he should have a right to his own quote, right?
Sure, sure, yeah.
This seems like something we might continue.
Sure.
Good.
Thank you. Well, just for my opinion, it would be enough to talk about conversation and not about language. Because if I specify languages, I exclude many, many cultures and milieus. To make conversation, I can do it in fantastic manners. So for example, with non-action icon, I am able to make conversation, for example. So for my opinion, I would prefer...
I understand, and I disagree. So I hope my way of talking about language was clear. It may not have been. It's about relations and distinctions. It's what I can talk about. It's what I can see. And there is a distinction between how I can operate with this way of seeing versus another way of seeing. And I don't know how to name that. There may be a better name than language. And quite often when I use the word language, people say, what do you mean by language? So that's why I try to contextualize it. It's the word we've used in the past in these works.
Because it's evident that I can act with responsibility without doing nothing. You know?
Without doing nothing or by doing nothing?
Except in situation where I have to do, where I have to act, for example.
Yes.
To help somebody, and I'm doing nothing.
So,
and then I act because I'm the cause for an effect. That's a question of cause and effect.
I think there is an action in language.
I think
though that there is an action in just speaking. And maybe this again is a distinction we can qualify.
Exactly. In penal law, it's very important to act in a certain situation.
Mm.
And if I don't act, I'm guilty or not guilty.
Yeah. It's beyond the scope tonight, but Pask talks about acting in this modeling facility. So you remember the diagram that looks like this, and there's this thing down the bottom that's an environment. He calls that a modeling facility. And that modeling facility may comprise only language utterances. I don't have to do this to say I can move the cup from one side to the other. That's a kind of action. And so I'm not sure whether or not we would agree that those are the same kinds of actions or not.
So it should be that in that case, my opinion is it's an empirical approach. Because then I have enough deduction,
yes.
Generalization,
yes.
But I don't have the logic, the theoretical logic for the European,
thank you very much.
European perspective.
I'm hearing again this word logic. I'd like to talk to you more about what you mean by that.
Okay, theoretical logic. Okay.
But thank you. I think that's part of it as well. I don't think it's a tool. I'd love to think about that more, but my instinct is that it's a world of being. It's a capacity. It's more constraining than a tool. A tool is something I apply to do something. If I can't think about it, if I can't talk about it, I can't do anything with it because I don't have the it. So it's almost like the creation of a world is what language is. But it's a great question. I'd love to explore that further.
If conversations gives us answers to problems we don't know yet,
yes.
How do you promote the conversations in a society that only wants something if the result of it can be given beforehand?
I wish I knew the answer to that. We would have answers to problems we spoke about earlier.
Yes.
It's and speaking of paradoxes.
And especially as the goal must be, if we go as conversations as the goal is the process,
yeah.
And the goal must be the change in the definitions,
yeah.
And how we're going to handle it,
yeah.
Through coming together.
Yeah.
But this we can't define beforehand.
Right.
But you have to educate it in
right.
The context. Otherwise, others don't join the conversation who want to be in power.
Yes. So this is why the only answer I have again. This is why we have to up-level to the point where we share sufficiently to keep going. Another point from Pask about conversations is it's a contract to keep going. You could leave right now. I can't make you stay. Why do you stay? Well, there's something here for you. There's something here for me. We're both here. We keep going. And so you have to find that common ground to continue. And that's a lot of the challenges that we have today, where there's such gross disagreements, big disagreements, that why should I even talk to you? This was the whole thing between the Democrats and the Republicans in the last election. You know, just the two sides didn't talk to one another. Still don't much.
Okay, let's take this as a final statement for today, for this evening. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for taking part in this very interesting discussion. Thank you for being polite enough. And yes, next first lecture will take place in November. You will read it if you are on our list, and if you put your name and email address on the list which was passed around, you will get information. Next lecturer will be Bill Seaman, next guest from the United States.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Albert. Thank you, Mariana. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Of course.
I haven't been following you much, not too much, definitely, in the last recent years or so.
Yeah.
But I happen to have read your paper, I'm Quitting Cybernetics.
Yes.
From 1995. and I read it again before
yes.
I came. And there was another thing in your talk today, which then made me happy.
Yeah.
What do you think, whether it did something, and if yes, what has really changed over the course of your life that you are observing?
About cybernetics? Or
no, I think in a more general way.
Nothing
like you've been pointing out the nothing, thank you. Like you pointed out the bigger problem.
Yeah.
And this is
those
always a
worse.
Point which prompts me in saying, wait, people always very often say this is a new thing. This is now the problem. And it is true, like climate change.
Yes, okay.
Right? But the fact that we always had problems
has not changed.
Has not changed. And when I read your paper, I felt like this, describing what happened to cybernetics, the funding problems, you quitting and why, and things and all that. And it all comes back, ever.
The cycle you want?
Yeah. So this was my question, whether you would somewhat agree with me that there are really second order wicked problems which just don't go away. And it's perhaps important because it's all it's what keeps us going. We come to a university and a department, we study, we learn, and then we figure something out and we are not happy with it, like with our parents and with our teachers, and we go on. And
certainly discontent is an engine. The AI thing keeps going through cycles.
Just now.
Cybernetics continues not to get very far. Case of this one is not, but I think I understand it. The world has gotten into worship. It's more perilous. It's kind of thing. Terrorism, resources, and so on. One of those is that old expression, there's nothing new under the sun except climate change.
Yeah, things are changing, that's clear.
Yeah.
It's just
that's
the change. And that's a cybernetic question for me.
Oh, I think the change has changed. Because a maximum resource limit or the heat death of the climate.
He said something similar about population growth.
Yeah, he thought it was going to be infinite. He was just trying to make a point.
That's it. That's what I mean.
I don't think he's
right. Yeah. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your question.
You said you know why cybernetics doesn't get further. So what is your why?
Oh, I have a series of arguments why. There are a number of reasons. I'm just trying to sort it out. There's no machine that cyberneticians could build that would compete with digital computers. Digital was somewhat cheaper, faster from the 50s, and they always seem to be making tremendous advances. And cybernetics can prove its value by doing a demonstration. And I have that idea. Number two, nobody wanted to pay for cybernetics the way people wanted to pay for physics or biology or computing. So there's no departments at universities, there were no businesses that were funding departments at universities, there's no research. I also feel I was arguing about this and another problem. The frame of cybernetics is not always palatable to certain kinds of scientists. Certainly the subjective bit was a problem. But Albert's point retort to me his feeling of what was much more important. Cybernetics is trans or cross-disciplinary. It devalues the fact that you're a biologist and you're a chemist. It says it doesn't matter, we're all in this together.
Well, you don't like that, and you don't like that.
So you're going to fight me, because I'm telling you that your silo is not as important as the generalities. So these are some of the reasons why I think cybernetics never got anywhere. And then Wiener had issues with the government.
But maybe with these kind of problems, okay, they are not, they were always rich problems, but maybe
at a prior conference somebody said to me that we should go to Google and show them Wiener's book and say, hi Google, you're here because of this book. Give me 0.01% of your revenue and you will pay that back. And you will be good.
Yeah. Not only this, maybe it could help them to develop their business model.
Well, it could put it in a better place. I think Facebook is the one that needs to be investing. Because Facebook has a billion users every day. Think of the mental bandwidth that Facebook is wasting on the planet.
Not to mention ruining people's sense of education and knowledge and all these other kinds of things. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. And you promised me the slides, just to remind, about this consultant business.
Yes, yeah. I will make a note.
Thank you.
Yes.
It fits to my way of thinking of patronizing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments.
The reason why I might end up with control is maybe because I was focusing too much on the individual applied selection mechanism rather than the system.
Yes.
So I think this was the step that took and caused that placement.
No, it's a reasonable proposition or way to think about it. The conventional way of thinking about power in organizations is people make decisions.
proposal you were asking about has this diagram which you proposed to accept, which is collective. Individuals within the collective make offers to participate, which are then judged by some other people who kind of know what's going on. So that's a selection mechanism there, and maybe prejudice and power and all kinds of things mixing in there. But if that individual contributes and does well, they should be rewarded. So the other idea about this is that the reward and recognition is not everyone's paid a salary, yes, but then if you offer to work on our project, even though we didn't know who you were or what you could offer, and you contribute to the project, then afterwards everyone who's in the project votes who gets the stipend. So again, it's a collective way of doing it. I've never brought this about, but it's a proposal that my colleagues and I made as a way of answering your question, which is the selection.
Another question I have is, have you thought of conceiving of this term in this language more in communication, in a communication sense? Because when you said that organization is its language, I was thinking of Niklas von Luhmann.
Yes.
And his argument that in the social system is communication.
So I have a little allergy to the word communication, partly because it's been used in so many different ways by so many people. And I want to preserve and even purvey Pask's notion of conversation, which has very different qualities. Yeah. Not all communication is conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I want that distinction. That's why I don't use communication. Conversation requires that something changes.
Yeah.
You know, hi, I'm home. Okay, you're home. Big deal. That's more like a message. It's a Shannon message, rather than the kinds of changes in mental models that occur as a result of two conversations.
It still appears consilient to me that Luhmann says it's only communication if it's like enabling a follow-up operation.
I agree. It's a vocabulary problem, and I tend not to use his vocabulary. I use Pask's, but I'm glad we mean the same.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you
for your question.
Thank you for this lecture.
Thank you for you.
Great. My name is Bertolt Thun. We are working while for keywords. Kubernetes.
Yeah.
Design-based research.
Yes.
Intellectual property.
Okay.
And international financial reporting standards.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And the Kubernetes, they gave us in our approach. Thank you. I will give you my card this way. As you demonstrated it today, the ground argumentation, you know, as a kind of architecture. Because intellectual property, creativity, you know, etc. So that's these four keywords. And we are in a very good way. We have the test bed, very good. We have the pilot. Yeah, we can demonstrate it. And if you agree, I would send you a handout. Just a handout of the status.
I would love to see that.
Thank you. I give you my card.
Please.
And I will introduce you. I will invite you in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
And I would love to hear from you.
Because we have a lot to do, a lot to do.
Yes.
And that's my private name, and that's our institute.
Wonderful. You know? Thank you so much.
And I was a judge for three years, and then 25 years a lawyer. And now I landed in qualitative social research. So,
congratulations.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Okay.
The main question for us, I'm not alone. group, it was middle 90s, was what's the value of the human being? That's the question.
It's a beautiful question.
That's the question, what is value?
Yes. Yes, of course.
For example, evaluation. There doesn't exist one, how do you call it, interview or not, evaluation theory.
Okay.
But the whole world evolves.
Yes.
And there is no theory.
Yes.
No theory.
Yes. Good. Good. I look forward to hearing more.
You reminded me in your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Russell. Thank you for your part.
Your way how to present, even to move, was very strongly influenced by Edith Ackerman.
Yeah. It was very strongly what?
Influenced by Edith Ackerman. So it was fine to give her the credit. You know, it's her way of acting, you know, when she was talking. I think you have taken
Edith Ackerman from there, you know. Thank you. Thank you very much.
What you have, sorry, because you will...
She was a very close friend of mine.
Yes, you know, that's how I got the mic. This is really... I was at the... sorry, not the funeral, but the memorial.
The memorial. Jack Lockett, I think, there as well. You know, Jack Lockett, he was a close friend.
He may have been one of the speakers, actually.
This is no, I don't think so. I communicated with... I think she had a Dutch name, one of the friends of Edith, who was organizing, and I sent a few words to her. But she was one of these, I think she had a Dutch name, she was one of the friends there at the MIT. Anyway, it's so that this, you know, and then we communicated and so on, and it was a shame, you know, because, I think only a few months before she got some kind of reward in Stanford, which I saw in the internet, you know, when they kind of awarded her that and so on, and when she got to know Ernst, she already had her first funerals and so on and so on. But then they became very close, and I think she was closing rank for him the last few months.
That would make sense, yes.
Okay, I'll see you there. You're going over there?
Yes, we are.
The methods that we were using were not bringing them to the point where they...
How long are you here for?
I'm back and forth. I leave tomorrow for Graz, and then I come back. I'm going to go up there at the Johannaeum. FH Johannaeum.
At the faculty now, what you're talking about.
I don't remember what FH is.
There is an FH.
Okay.
That would be the faculty.
Yes, fine. That's what it comes out to.
I think there's this small book in Manfred Kühlschach.
No, I know.
He's talking about Greensmith Carlson.
You know Carl?
Carl Schrocker was already with the university before, but I heard Manfred Kühlschach.
Carl invited me. And then I told him back here on Saturday.
They had had like this where.
That's probably. No, that's, I think, you got that.
That's Mark.
Ah, that's you in Russian.
How far do you go?
Home is about 15 minutes, 10 minutes. The second is
good. A little bit. So? Is that okay? Really? I never know.
He understood so much more.
That's a good point.
I think it's... Direction to the Stadt, zum Stadtkind. Können wir diese...